Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. It was a little bit like your college dorm on finals week. You and your closest friends pulling an all-nighter to try to get by in those tests. Only this time, the goal wasn't to get an A or to pass. It was the Senate Democrats trying to rally the public to force one more of their Republican colleagues to vote against Betsy DeVos for Education Secretary.
Just one more Republican, and we can say that this Senate puts kids ahead of partisan politics. Just one more Republican, and we can say that this Senate still cares about public officials who put the public ahead of their own interests. Just one more Republican. That's all we need. Just one.
Senator Elizabeth Warren trying to coax that final vote out of thin air. They already have two Republicans, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. Senate math means they need one more Republican who thinks DeVos is too uneducated about education to be confirmed. We will see if the politics turn for one more red state senator or Republican senator in a largely blue state with the avalanche of phone calls that continue to come in, apparently. Meanwhile, the White House is pushing back on a New York Times story from yesterday based on interviews with dozens of sources that describes the president as increasingly frustrated by the efforts of a small team to contain the backlash to his policies. And shockingly, it seems to describe the president as not fully briefed by Steve Bannon on the executive order that elevated Bannon himself to the National Security Council. That story was written by Times correspondents Glenn Thrush and Maggie Haberman. Maggie joins us now. Hi, Maggie. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Tavis Smiley, the commentator and public radio and television host who was on Meet the Press on Sunday, saying the president may have gotten at least one thing right, this exchange with Bill O'Reilly on Fox News Channel.
Putin's a killer. A lot of killers. We got a lot of killers. Well, you think our country's so innocent? You think our country's so innocent?
I don't know of any government leaders that are killers in America.
Well, take a look at what we've done, too. We've made a lot of mistakes. I've been against the war in Iraq from the beginning.
Yeah, mistakes are different then.
A lot of mistakes. Okay, but a lot of people were killed. So a lot of killers around, believe me.
Bill O'Reilly and the president recorded Saturday. Tavis, welcome back. And why did you single out that exchange on TV the other day?
Thank you, Brian.
Tell us why you singled out that exchange for comment on Meet the Press.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. My grandmother, who we called Big Mama, used to say to me all the time that Tavis, baby, a broken clock is right twice a day. I recall those words from her because Donald Trump, every now and then, no matter how hard he tries to lie to us about everything else, every now and then some truth, I think, is going to eke out. And on this one, he was absolutely right. And it was fascinating for me to be in, as you know, I live in Los Angeles, but fascinating as always to go to Washington to do these shows or whatever else I'm doing. You can hear, you can sense, you can feel how Washington just circles the wagons whenever our government is criticized or compared to somebody else that we think is less than who we are. This whole spirit of American exceptionalism starts to rise up in our politics, in our words. And so he's right about that, though. America has a very shoddy record. I love my country, but I think a true patriot doesn't excuse its sins. And I don't think one has to be a student of history to understand. And Mr. Riley is wrong. It's not just mistakes we've made. We have had, as part of our foreign policy, propping up dictators, running rogue regimes, helping to run rogue regimes. And it's not even just historically, even now. Barack Obama killed more innocent women and children with this drone program on steroids than any president prior to him. So that it's not even just historically, even in the moment.
That wasn't to prop up a rogue regime, though, right? That was to get individual terrorists.
Oh, no, yeah. I'm not saying in that particular case. But he's killed innocent women and children nonetheless because his drone program has been out of control.
I think it was 50 years ago this April at Riverside Church here in Manhattan that Martin Luther King called the United States the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. That was during Vietnam. Can you imagine if President Obama as a black man in America today or even any other mainstream Democrat had said, you think we're so innocent and equated us with Putin.
I mean, they came after Trump pretty quickly, and it wasn't even just – here's the funny thing I was trying to raise earlier. It wasn't even just the Republicans that came after him, Democrats as well. This is one of those issues on which Washington does not want to acknowledge, you know, the errors, the misjudgments, the mistakes, whatever you want to call it, of our own judgment, not to mention it's not even just domestic terror. It's not even just international terror. There's domestic terror. This is the same country whose first original sin was not slavery. People always say that, and they're well-intentioned. America's first – our original sin was not slavery, it's what we did to the Native Americans. But so the original sin was how we massacred the Native Americans, and then slavery was our second sin. So we've had domestic terror. We still have, to some degree, domestic terror. You look at what's happened to these kids in the streets at the hands of some of these cops. So we've had domestic terrorism. We've had international terrorism that we've engaged in. And so King was right 50 years ago, and in some respects, he might be right today, that America in some ways is still a great purveyor of violence around the globe. But when King said that 50 years ago at the Riverside Church, he was pushed back on. It was the most controversial talk of his entire life. I'll be back in New York, as a matter of fact, in April to do my PBS show live from there to celebrate that anniversary of that speech that most Americans beyond Vietnam just don't know. But in this critical moment, would be well to reread.
Just one other thing before we bring in Maggie. Certainly, police all over the country would bristle at that comparison of whatever mistakes they make in violence as they see it on the streets today to genocide against the Indians.
I stand by that. What's happening to too many young black and brown kids is terror. It's terror in their eyes. It's terror for their families when these kids are shot and killed innocently, oftentimes in New York and beyond, without weapons in their hands or on their person. That's terror. And it's tragic for me, quite frankly, when people look at everything else as terror but can't look at the traumatization that's happening to black communities as domestic terror. That's what it is, and I would not back down from that.
So, Maggie Haberman, just to stay on this point for a second with you, on the whole backlash to the, you know, Trump-Putin comments, like you think we're so innocent with Bill O'Reilly, mm-hmm. does this mean that the Democrats are being hypocritical too, suddenly being the ones who are all sweetness and light about American history to make Trump look unpatriotic when they would be kind of close in general, not maybe all the way to where Tavis just was, but kind of close to that historically?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. Look, I think that I think two things, and I think that they are separate. One is that I do think that you have seen, not just on this issue, but on a number of issues. And to be clear, I think that Trump is going a little further than what we have seen previously. You know, in what he has said about Putin, and also, you know, the person he's characterizing as, you know, as strong and a good leader over Obama. But I do think that there is this sort of purity that is being embraced by Trump's critics, particularly Democrats, on a lot of different issues. I mean, one of the things that is sort of a complicating factor right now is that the people who are among the most vocal critics of Trump are both former Clinton operatives and people who were incredibly defensive of and protective of Hillary Clinton's campaign. For doing, you know, similar things in terms of conflicts. You know, if you talk about a conflict of interest, if you talk about, you know, the Clinton Foundation is obviously a charity, but it there were a number of controversies about it, and there were a number of questions about whether it was also helping to leverage influence. You know, the Clintons were outraged that anybody would suggest that, and yet. You are seeing sort of the Trump presidency, I think, is an exaggerated version in a lot of ways of what we had seen on the Democratic side. And to your more specific point, yes, I do think that there is some hypocrisy there. I also think that Trump, I know that this stirs up a lot of sort of the intrigue around Trump and Russia when he says things like this, but Trump has a 30-year history, and Brian, I think you know this too, of you know, praising and admiring people who in this country have been described as dictators or strongmen. Going back to a 1990 interview that he did with Playboy magazine where he you know, sort of spoke admiringly of how the Chinese government put down the dissidents in Tiananmen Square. I mean, there were hundreds of people killed. But he described that as an act of strength to wipe out dissent, and this is something he admires.
And this is one of the reasons why people are so inflamed around the country, and why there is so much fear of him not just trying to have better relations with Putin, but using Putin as a model for authoritarian government here. So to the point of your article, or one of the points, the president just keeps provoking everyone with comments like that about America being a killer like Putin, and saying so-called judge about the Bush appointee who issued the temporary restraining order against the travel ban. Mm-hmm. And those were just this weekend's examples. I tend to be in the camp that believes that this is almost all calculated, because he does win politically by saying things like these, no matter the backlash.
Yep.
But your article seems to suggest otherwise. So what's getting him frustrated?
No, I mean, I think that, look, what's getting him frustrated, I agree with you that I think that the split screen that you are seeing on TV, which is of Trump doing XYZ and talking about terrorism and meeting with people on trade, you know, while on the other side you see protests and you see a federal judge in Washington State putting a nationwide halt on this travel ban. That is the split screen that some of Trump's advisors, I think most specifically Steve Bannon and Steve Miller, want. Trump has a different view of this. I mean, Trump really wants and needs to be liked, and he gets very frustrated when he's not. And so I think that there is a point at which the lack of approval of him, not just in terms of the protests, which I think he can rationalize because he's been protested before, you know, as a developer in New York, but the fact that he's sitting in establishment Washington, having in his mind found his way inside the most expansive and significant piece of real estate in the country, and he's still not treated seriously and still disliked by these congressional leaders, and he knows it, I think that is very frustrating to him. And he, you know, he's obsessed, as you know, with his media coverage, and he believes the press has not given him his due.
Listeners, people are tweeting us and starting to call us like crazy on all this so far, so our Twitter handle is at Brian Lehrer. Somebody tweets, for example, Tavis, the main difference regarding, I guess this is about Trump, and this is about Trump saying killers in U.S. history and Putin. The main difference is that Trump wasn't reflecting on the humanity of innocence, but rather defending Putin to make his point. Interesting observation by a listener. Yes.
But it doesn't change the facts. I take the point. It's a nuanced point, but it doesn't change the facts. The fact is that President Trump said, it's not like we're so innocent. We've had killers, too. About those points, he is absolutely right. And again, so many of us are so disgusted by Donald Trump. I understand that. I don't like this guy either. But we're so disgusted by him that even when a truth comes out of his mouth, we don't want to acknowledge it. One, because it's him. Two, we don't want to side with this guy. And three, it makes us look in the mirror and confront who we are as a nation and try to match our ideals with the ideas that are coming out of his mouth. We might not like the ideas coming out of his mouth, but when they don't match with the ideals we profess as a nation, we don't really want to look at America for who she has been, who she is, which I think only makes us better about becoming who we want to be.
And we'll try to get some phone calls in, though we have a lot to cover with PBS and PRI hosts Tavis Smiley and Maggie Haberman, New York Times correspondent. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I'm going to play a clip of White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, Maggie, pushing back at his daily press briefing yesterday on your story specifically, and then let me get your reaction to becoming part of the story like this.
I would just say that story was so riddled with inaccuracies and lies that they owe the president an apology for the way that thing was. There were just literally blatant factual errors, and it's unacceptable to see that kind of reporting or so-called reporting. That is literally the epitome of fake news.
Part of that story was the detail.
You start at the top. I don't think the president owns a bathrobe. Definitely doesn't wear one. There was no meetings and conference room. I mean, it's just from top to bottom, it made up stories that just don't exist. And I think that's unfortunate for people, but that look to, you know, news institutions like that for their news, because it is just not an accurate portrayal of what's really happening.
Was the president specifically was claim just, about the, whether sorry? He was briefed on the order? Makeup of the NSC.
What's that?
The story talked about how the president is disappointed that he hadn't been adequately briefed.
The president
the
is briefed on all aspects of
so
what goes on.
That specifically. What was he told and who briefed talked about.
I'm not going to get into details. I would say that the president is clearly aware of the policies that come out of the White House with his name on them. That is what I was getting at earlier to Steve. The president's, you know, when it comes to decisions and policy, it's the president who leads, the president who tells us how to implement it.
Sean Spicer doing his best Melissa McCarthy imitation with our guest Maggie Haberman as the target, along with her Times colleague Glenn Thrush. Maggie, were you in the room for that?
No, he was. I think that was on Air Force One. That wasn't
at the press briefing.
No, Trump was. There was no daily briefing yesterday from the briefing room. The next Sean Spicer show is at 1:30 today for those who want to tune in. But there were fewer pieces of gum, I think, than the Melissa McCarthy impression in this one. But I mean, look.
He also is very affable at times with the press.
Sean?
Yeah.
Oh no, look. I've worked with Sean Spicer for a very, very long time. He's smart. He can be very genial. He also has a temper, and so in that way, I don't know if he's necessarily a huge check on Trump's own impulse to punch the press, because Spicer comes to that. Someone on his own too, but on the other hand, Spicer has a pretty decent radar for how certain things will play. Sean Spicer was made aware by my colleague Glenn of all details that were going to be in the story. They did not offer pushback beforehand, so one always needs to be skeptical of that. We're still waiting for the list of things that were inaccurate. We've asked for it. The bathrobe detail, I'm told, is the one that upset the president. To me, this is a pretty minor detail in a story that was filled with many, and it was really we were trying to offer a panorama of the presidency. This was not supposed to be another in a series of, you know, who's up, who's down between Steve Bannon and Reince Priebus, which I think has become somewhat uninteresting to people. We were trying to talk about the president, and Americans, as you know, are whether they should be or not, there is a long tradition of people being very invested in and interested in what their president's lives are like. There's also, you know, any number of pictures of previous presidents wearing bathrobes. Three of them Republicans. So this didn't strike me as controversial, and we're comfortable in our sourcing. But this is sort of what Trump did throughout the campaign, which is he would seize on one thing, and then if there wasn't anything, he would just kick up dust to try to obscure from other reporting in it. In terms of the piece about Steve Bannon, to be clear, was not Bannon's job to brief the president, and the issue was that was the duty of another advisor to the president, and the issue was not that Trump didn't know that he was putting Bannon on the NSC. He had not been fully briefed on the language of the executive order as to how it was different from previous executive orders, mm-hmm. what it would mean in terms of other people serving on the NSC, and those who would get a seat versus those who wouldn't, and in terms of just sort of the potential for fallout from it. And he was angrier about that because Trump really doesn't like being caught off guard.
Ryan in Clark, New Jersey. You're on WNYC with Maggie Haberman and Tavis Smiley. Hello, Ryan.
Your caller earlier had a point about Trump comparing Putin to America's demons. And America certainly has murderers and demons in its past and present. But isn't there a moral difference between Putin, like, ordering assassinations of political rivals versus a drone system that is essentially, you know, conducting a war?
Tavis, that's for you.
Well, two things. One, I'm not sure there is much of a difference when you understand and you can read. These stories came out repeatedly in the New York Times during the Obama era, since Maggie's on, how the president, every Monday, as I recall, would make a decision about who would get killed. He made decisions, Barack Obama made decisions on who would be on our assassins list. And so we do the same thing, number one. Number two, you all recall the fallout when we're still in it, quite frankly. We thought Russia hacked into and somehow impacted the outcome of this election. We quickly forgot that we had Angela Merkel's phone tapped in Germany, and Obama had to apologize to her face-to-face. We do the same thing, spying and hacking on people. Everybody does it, number two. And number three, what I tried to say Sunday, Brian, on Meet the Press that you referenced was not so much that it was a moral equivalency, I called it an immoral equivalency. It's an immoral equivalency, and we, again, have to acknowledge and accept the fact and not hunker down and try to defend ourselves and become patriots and nationalists. We have made mistakes. We continue to make mistakes, and the only way we correct those mistakes is to acknowledge those mistakes, and the fact that it came out of his mouth doesn't make it any less right.
Nancy in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I guess what my comment was and what kind of disturbed me was the President Trump seems, while it is true, it's disturbing coming out of his mouth because reportedly he has put a portrait of Andrew Jackson in the Oval Office, who is one of the least compassionate presidents we've had. So it's as if he's proud of this as opposed to...
That's your segue from genocide against the Indians. Tavis, I'll give you that one, too. You have a reaction to his reposting the photo of Andrew Jackson. One of the famous things that's being quoted recently from Andrew Jackson is his kind of, you know, sneering at the courts and saying, well, if I follow your order. And it's been disturbing, although so far certainly the government has followed the court order on the travel ban. At least to a large degree, I'm not sure they've done it 100%, that we even have to ask the question, will the President of the United States defy an order from an appeals court or the United States Supreme Court even?
No, I think maybe it's worth saying this now because it hasn't come up as yet in the conversation because these aren't the questions you've asked me. You asked me specifically about my comments about his Putin remarks. But let me just say this. If you watch the tape of the Sunday show on Meet the Press, you will see me say the following, which has really gotten, I think, more people upset. I said in the campaign, in the conversation that I think that too many of us in the media and beyond have rushed to normalize a racist, sexist, classist campaign that Donald Trump won, that he ran, to win the presidency. It was full of racism and classism and sexism and more, and he won, and now we're rushing to normalize that. They trampled on the Constitution just a year ago, and now we're rushing to normalize a process to seat another nominee to the Supreme Court, one that they like. My point is that this kind of behavior, once normalized, becomes part of the DNA of our democracy, and I don't like that, and so I am not a fan of Donald Trump. I do not believe he was the best choice for this country. I don't believe much about him at all that comes out of his mouth, etc., etc., etc. Having said all of that, none of that detracts from the fact, as scary, as ugly, as horrific as he may be, it doesn't detract from the singular point that you asked me about earlier, which is whether or not America has some skeletons in the closet.
And I was going to get to your not normalizing statement, and I've seen some of that pushback. Here's a maybe not normalizing example of the media. This is the beginning of the CBS Evening News last night. This is the usually reserved broadcast with anchor Scott Pelley. Listen to his first words after saying this is the CBS Evening News.
President Trump told a U.S. military audience that there have been terrorist attacks that no one knows about because the media choose not to report them. It has been a busy day for presidential statements divorced from reality. Mr. Trump said this morning that any polls that show disapproval of his immigration ban are fake. He singled out a federal judge for ridicule after the judge suspended his ban, and Mr. Trump said that the ruling now means that anyone can enter the country. The president's claims, whether imaginary or fabricated, are now worrying even his backers, particularly after he insisted that millions of people voted illegally, giving Hillary Clinton her popular vote victory. There's not one state election official, Democrat or Republican, who supports that claim.
Wow, Tavis, how about those words for the beginning of the CBS Evening News?
Wow is the right word. Three things come to mind. Number one, after the hell they went through with Dan Rather, they are not going to get caught on their heels this time, number one. Number two, you expect that when people are attacked the way that Mr. Trump keeps attacking them, at some point they're going to grow a spine. They're going to push back. So I'm glad to see CBS and Scott Pelley do that. So it's a good thing all around, but that's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that we got two choices here. It's going to either be resistance or it's going to be acquiescence. And if we allow this particular president to demonize every institution in this country because he doesn't like them, what they say about him, then we're in trouble. So if the choice again is resistance or acquiescence, we have to side with resistance. And I think that's what you heard from Scott Pelley last night.
Maggie, what do you think about that clip?
I mean, I thought it was very well done. I think that yesterday was sort of an extraordinary day in alternate reality. But I think that what you're talking about, and I think this is where the word normalizing, which I confess to chafing at, because I think that it is being applied to a number of things that are just simply routine, you know, matters of coverage. He is the president. But there are other issues where it obviously does apply. I think this is an extension of a problem that the media writ large has had throughout the entire Trump campaign. And yes, he is the president now, but it still feels very much like he's still in campaign mode. And I think he's intentionally doing that to try to, demonize the press and turn them into an opponent, turn us into an opponent. I think that it's very hard to know exactly how, and we're still struggling with it. As you know, Brian, for a very long time, the types of things that Trump said, I mean, we had a sort of a proto-candidacy for Trump in New York in 2010 in the gubernatorial nomination of Carl Palladino to challenge Andrew Cuomo. And a lot of the same issues, and in many cases, some of the same commentary, not to the same extreme. Palladino made overt and clearly racist statements that were different and impossible for Republicans to either defend and or stand with. Trump has done a more muted version of some of this, but it was a lot of the same things, and you typically saw those on the fringe of the party. And I think that the media has sort of been trained to or in the habit of ignoring things like that and not covering it and not giving it credence. Well, how do you cover it when it's coming from the Republican nominee? Or how do you cover it when it's coming from the president, the sitting president of the United States? Just a headline saying Trump says does not tell the reader that what he's saying is not true. And so that's why I think that clip was very powerful last night, because it did not present it as here's what he says, but in fact, or but on the other hand, the enormity of the statement that the media is not covering terrorist attacks is huge and creates the impression that there is much more to fear than people are aware of.
Let me play that clip in case people haven't heard it. This is one of the things that Scott Pelley was referring to in that litany of unrealities from the president. This is a dark, false, and conspiracy-minded comment yesterday about the press supposedly not reporting terrorist attacks.
It's gotten to a point where it's not being reported. And in many cases, the very, very dishonest press doesn't want to report it. They have their reasons, and you understand that.
So, Maggie, what do you make of they have their reasons, and you understand that? Talk about conspiracy theory.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's an othering that Trump engages in, and he has for the last 18 months, othering of certain groups, othering of the media, and this is a way of everything with Trump is a way to kind of sand things down to its nub, where it's sort of a clear good or bad, black or white. And in this case, it's the media is bad, and the media is bad because they're defending the bad guys. That's essentially what that comment is. It isn't true. As you know well, a lot of the media that is national is also local in New York. We all lived through and covered the September 11th terrorist attacks on our city. Where I don't remember seeing Donald Trump down at the site very often. We have all covered attacks ranging from Orlando for days and days and days at the Pulse nightclub, San Bernardino, the attacks overseas in Paris, in Nice. I mean, the list really goes on. The sad reality is that attacks that tend to involve fewer victims do get less coverage.
And that are further from home.
Correct.
So if there's something in a country that seems remote to Americans that doesn't result in a lot of casualties or injuries, let's say, it's
right.
Not going to wind up on the front page of the New York Times.
Right. Or the lead of the evening news.
Right. But Tavis, to be very, to just say it, he's dog whistling to his supporters that the mainstream media are on ISIS's side. right?
He is dog whistling that, and at the risk of being politically incorrect yet again in this 30-minute conversation, let me say that, and this is not a comment about Maggie, who I respect and love her work. It's a comment about our profession, about the media writ large, and this is not new coming out of my mouth. It is fascinating for me, almost tickles me, to hear the media now push back, as Mr. Pelley did last night, correctly, no doubt about that. But fascinating to hear the same mainstream media push back on him now that helped create Donald Trump. During the campaign, the numbers are abundantly clear. In the press, Donald Trump got all the coverage. Look at the numbers. Everybody's seen the numbers. They wouldn't give Bernie Sanders press. They wouldn't give others press. Everybody focused on Donald Trump. We helped to create this monster. And now that he's in the White House, the truth is, after helping to create him, now we want to demonize the guy. He deserves to be checked. There's no doubt about that. But I hope we learn next time around that when you create a monster like this, you have to deal with that monster. And the media owes an apology. They were wrong about it. In the end, they were complicit in this. And now everybody's upset about Donald Trump. You weren't upset during the campaign, and you should have given some other people some coverage.
Maggie, before you go, just one thing additionally from your article. You reported that the expectation of protests forced the president to cancel a trip to Milwaukee last week. Potential protests had that much effect?
Yes. I mean, I think that they were concerned about but I don't think this was the White House. I mean, my understanding is that this was Harley Davidson that said maybe it would be better if we don't do it here. Look, I mean, I think that you're seeing companies trying to figure out what to do about the threat that brand damage, either by affiliation with or by being targeted by the president, can do. On the other hand, you also saw the Harley-Davidson executives go to the White House, so they're not that afraid.
Right. We're going to be doing a segment, folks, in a half hour from now on the tortured relationship between companies in America and the Trump White House and various pushback. Trump supporters are asking everybody to boycott certain companies. Trump detractors are asking people to boycott certain companies, and we'll try to pick that apart. But to that point of the protest, Tavis, last word for this segment. How do you think the resistance to Trump is going, the not normalization? You know, Matthew Iglesias and some other commentators, he's on Vox, I think, are saying, yes, the resistance is beginning to slow him and the Republican Congress down, scaling back the travel ban. The Congress gave up on watering down ethics rules. They now say it'll take a year to repeal and replace Obamacare. How do you see the scorecard and the futility or non-futility of resistance?
For those of us who want to make America a nation that will one day be as good as its promise, we have no other choice. Failure is not an option here. We cannot engage what some have called resistance fatigue. We cannot get stricken with resistance fatigue. I will close, as I said on Sunday. My grandfather said all the time, Brian, there's some fights that ain't worth fighting even if you win. There are other fights you have to fight even if you lose. For the sake of this democracy, this is a fight that we must engage and a fight that we cannot afford to lose.
And listeners will be doing more on the resistance to Trump on my national call-in show tonight at 8 o'clock here on WNYC, the Tuesday night edition of Indivisible. Don't worry, Tavis, this is not on opposite the Tavis Smiley PBS show. And that, of course, is later on Channel 13. The Tavis Smiley radio show also airs Saturdays at 11 p.m. on AM 820 WNYC. And Maggie Haberman, we will continue to read your dogged coverage in the New York Times.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you both very much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We continue.